Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, something that has changed a lot in the past two decades is drug policy. But it's not due to efforts from the federal government, but the bulk of it is from efforts from the states. Why is that? Where is this headed? And what's driving the changes? And so today I'm happy to be joined by Leal Bouharfouch, a drug policy analyst at the Libertarian Reason Foundation. Leal, welcome.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me.
What's going on in drug policy right now?
Well, quite a bit. We are in kind of like a really, really big just framework shift right now. For the longest time, the focus has been on abstinence. So the idea that progress or success only counts if someone completely stops using substances. But for so many people, that's just really not realistic. So what we're seeing right now is a move towards harm reduction, which is about saving lives and preventing disease rather than making only abstinence the goal. So that's my area of work. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be hopeful about in that sense. People are finally having real conversations about harm reduction, things like safe consumption sites or making naloxone more accessible, the medication that reduces overdoses. But at the same time, there's still a lot of resistance from folks who are just kind of stuck in that old way of thinking, who see substance use as something to punish rather than to address with compassion. So it's an exciting time to be in this space because we know harm reduction works. We have a lot of data that backs stories and the results to prove that harm reduction is the way to go. There's like a real call for a shift in that sense. So it's an exciting time, lots of room for innovation and lots of really great discussions being had.
So my understanding of harm reduction, it's a strategy of addressing drug issues, but it covers a wide variety of things. Like,
oh yeah,
we're told vaping is harm reduction.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that's very different, at least to me, from safe injection sites. Like that seems to be a far more controversial thing than vaping. And right. Safe injection sites are, I believe, places where you can do injectable drugs, but there's someone who is administering it to make sure that you won't die.
Right. Yeah, very, there's harm reduction can be taken so many different ways. I like to explain it as more of like a mentality, an approach, almost like a framework to solving issues, which the issues can span, you know, amongst a lot of things, even gambling, you know, so like harm reduction is a super diverse area to be in.
Okay, so I kind of want to talk about, because you've already brought up two competing frameworks for how to approach this effort, abstinence and harm reduction. Abstinence being drugs are bad and we should do whatever we can to encourage people to not do drugs. Right. And harm reduction, I think you can come at it from a lot of things, as in drugs are perfectly fine, but also drugs might be bad, but we should really try to seek not recognize that we can't keep drugs out of our prisons, let alone the rest of the country. Acknowledging that we live in a world where people are going to do this, how can we make sure that society doesn't have a massive cost and that people aren't harmed by these substances? So can you tell me about who's winning?
Right. Very complicated conversation. I think that we are headed in the harm reduction direction. But we're very much at ground zero when it comes to changing that narrative because, you know, we've been kind of just taught for so long that people who use drugs are almost like a other, you know, like they're in another group. You know, it kind of removes that kind of human nature, that empathy that should come with, you know, addressing an issue as vulnerable as that. And so when we've just been, told for so long that that's the case, right? It's really hard to start shifting that societal narrative. I like to kind of translate that into my work, is that my role is to bring empathy and human nature back into the conversation, right? Like, I am so ready to talk about drugs. You know what I mean? Talk about it. when we go to our Koch Associate Program Fellowship, summits where we meet with other, future policy leaders and things like that, I very quickly branded myself as like the drug girl. They're like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I do drugs. And they're like, oh, man. So we, that's how we kind of start to make that topic a little bit more of a human discussion instead of, oh, it's too taboo or this is weird to start talking about it, So I think as a society, we're still trying to climb up to drug users are still humans and, that we should treat the problem in that way. So it's hard to say who's winning. I am hopeful that we will win in the end. But right now, there's still a lot of tug and pull.
So before, I do want to get into like where that's headed. But you brought up something, and I got to ask, how do you bring in humanity and empathy to this issue?
Well, I mean, one of the root ways that I do that is by bringing up that there is a large portion and a diverse array of, paths to get to a place where someone is affected by a substance use disorder. So like, I like to bring up a lot of like the firsthand clinical experience that I've had. I come from a clinical background. This is my first venture in policy. I was a senior coordinator at Johns Hopkins in the Division of Addiction Medicine. So I worked a lot with providing medication for opioid use disorder in a hospital system in Baltimore, the Johns Hopkins Baby Medical Center. And that project really allowed me to kind of get a lot of narratives under my belt. I mean, I worked with patients every single day with a variety of age ranges from a bunch of social demographic backgrounds. And it just really allowed you to experience the like beyond the data. Mm-hmm. Know what I'm saying? Like,
put some faces to the issue.
Yes.
As opposed to theory, which is like, if you don't run into people who are struggling with this one or struggling with drugs or being harmed by drugs, it's you can only theorize about them. You have the experience working with them.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. And so like, who can't connect with a story, when you put a lot of like, relatable aspects to that narrative, So I find that sharing narratives, really relying on people with lived experience to say, you know what, I'm going to share this story, to the extent that I can, right? I'm not breaking any HIPAA laws here. But to the extent that I can share the stories, I find that that's super impactful in changing lives and changing perspectives. So
can you share one with us?
Oh, yeah. So I was at a conference. This conference was very interdisciplinary, specifically for the world of addictions and drug use. So we had sociologists, we had epidemiologists, we had, clinical researchers like myself, MDs, DOs, all from all the spectrum of people who work in the addiction medicine field. And what was so special about this conference is they brought up people with lived experience to talk about what they went through. There was a woman who got up and she started talking about how she was injected with heroin since she was a baby.
Really?
Yeah. And regardless of the fact that she had no choice in her disorder, she was still met with a lot of the barriers and the inequities that come with a life like that. Mm-hmm. And so, that's one whenever I tell, it's a it's a always just like a silent effect, right? Like you can hear the pin drop because, you know,
because babies shouldn't be injected heroin.
Because babies shouldn't be injected with heroin, yes. And also, like, when we think about drug users, we don't think of them as oh, okay, some may have not had a choice in the matter to end up in a place where they were addicted to this substance, right? So how are we going to establish policies that are blanket and just say, you know what, like, this is a one size fits all for a situation where it's truly not a one size fits all, right? It's not just a social issue. It's not just an environmental safety issue. It's not just a healthcare issue. It spans so many different, aspects of life. And so how are we going to cover it with a blanket and imagine it and pretend like it's effective, right? Mm-hmm. So.
And I can see then, like with a case like that, why harm reductions seem to be a pivotal strategy. Because it's like, look, these things are there. They're causing harms. We've got to find some type of way to live a more civilized life with the reality that there's just these things in the world.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. It allows for that gray. Everything is not black and white. And especially when you're talking about behavioral health, there is no black and white in this situation. So we need a change in mindset here.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of these harm reduction strategies. What are some people doing around the country to try to implement harm reduction strategies?
So Portugal has a pretty prominent decriminalization program. And I think it stands as a really great global model, for health policy reform everywhere else. I was just writing a harm reduction brief on it. And so at the heart of the model is sort of this committee, the dissuasion of drug addictions, which is really similar to what we have in the United States, what we're starting to have, I should say. It's still pretty slim, but addiction consult services. So basically it mixes a medical doctor with a social worker, with like a mid-level practitioner to discuss, and a legal professional to discuss like what's the best course of action for this person. And there's tiers, you know, depending on the amount of substance they got caught with and like to what level their disorder is, because, you know, there's like a range. You could have a mild substance use disorder to severe, you know, so there's different steps in the matter. But instead of just, okay, you got caught with this amount of substance, let's throw you in a prison with no treatment options and you know, let's just not talk about the source of the problem. Let's just go ahead and just, you know, sentence you. They're really addressing the core problems of a substance use disorder. So, and it yielded really great outcomes. There was a dramatic decline in drug-related deaths. I think the number, if I remember correctly, was about 6 deaths per million compared to the European Union average, which was somewhere around 24. Deaths per million.
All right. So I want to dig on this because you said the way that you described it, I think it takes an approach that I think some people might be surprised at. Because when you say decriminalization, it is drugs were bad, now they're good. And feel free to do whatever. But in this case, at least for the dissuasion portions of it, it's still the government, ostensibly people's will, saying drugs are still kind of bad. Let's try to get, or if you've got a problem, let's try and find ways to get you off of that. And we'll do this at some public expense. And so there's still some type of state moral sanction against the activity, which is different from how a lot of people hear about decriminalization.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they hear decriminalization, they're just immediately like, I could go to the store and I could buy some heroin or I could buy some fentanyl off the shelf and, everything's fine.
There was a joke that Brian Doherty told in the book Radicals for Capitalism,
Yeah.
to kind of poke fun at, in general, libertarians. It's like, you libertarian, and there's libertarians in a policy debate, and the opposition goes, you libertarians are the kind of people who would let kids buy bazookas from vending machines in public parks. To which the libertarian responds, what do you mean, public parks?
That's exactly what I imagine people are thinking when I say decriminalization, because the look on their face is like, what are you even talking about right now? And I'm like, okay, well, let's talk about what that really means. Decriminalization, I mean it, it's especially coming from the clinical background that I have, is to offer to the availability or the ability to offer more treatment options for people who are struggling. Right now, the medication for any use disorder, there's only a handful of medications for any, from opioid to alcohol use disorders on the market right now. Imagine opening that up to a lot of these, the various drugs that are out there, to be able to be distributed in a therapeutic way. Because right now, right, we have methadone, we have buprenorphine. These are still opioids, right? We are just giving them in a controlled way. So when I talk about decriminalization, I talk about opening up the availability for that treatment option, not to make it available at a vending machine. So whenever I explain it that way, people are like, oh, I've never really heard it like that before. I'm like, yeah, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about, just the availability for that good, for that good. I mean, like, we're already doing it in a sense, right? Like, people still use methadone and buprenorphine illicitly. Why can't we open it up to more options? And so that's more so what I talk about when I'm talking about in terms of decrim, is like, how can we use that in the harm reduction framework? And that's what I mean.
What are the biggest harms of drugs in America right now?
Oh, well, you know what is the drug that does the most harm, but is actually the most socially acceptable?
Probably alcohol.
Absolutely. So there's also a lot of misconceptions around just safety, public safety, and drug use and things like that. When you reframe it that way, when you bring up that alcohol is actually one of the most socially accepted drugs and causes the most public disturbances in a given year, right? Then we can start getting into the real. About what kind of effects other substances have.
Okay, so I guess I'm going to go off on a tangent here,
Yeah.
because, I mean, alcohol was viewed so much as a social ill that we passed or we got rid of it by a federal government action. It took a large activity through the prohibition movement.
Right.
But then, when we did that, we realized that we didn't exactly stop alcohol, and re-legalized it in some strange ways that wound up creating systems that get captured by special interests and alcohol control policy. Unfortunately, is unfortunately too often used to enrich a couple of people at the public's expense than to protect people from from alcohol's harms. But I assume that experience was a case of United States harm reduction as well, at least the re-legalization efforts.
Well, I have a slightly different outlook on that. I think, re-legalization of it and everything, yeah, we're moving better in the right direction. Obviously, prohibition didn't work, and it wasn't going to work because, like what federal government action that tries to, just cap this entire market is ever going to work well. And you know what I mean? So I think that, you know, I think that that was a step in the right direction of harm reduction. But, you know, there's a little bit more layers to that, which is like, you know, the treating like alcohol use disorders as a disorder. I mean, like when, you know, you talk about alcohol use disorder, it's kind of hard to, I guess, from even a social level, the admittance factor of it being an alcohol use disorder is a bit hard. And then navigating that. So I guess just because it's more socially acceptable, here's what I'm trying to say, is because it's socially acceptable, that social acceptability prevents people from seeing it as a problem. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So
whereas for some other things, it's like, because of the social non-acceptability of other types of drugs, we refuse to try to even attempt harm mitigation because we think prohibition ought to be the effective strategy and the preferred option.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Okay. So, and again, we've talked that harm reduction strategies do have a broad, like there are a lot of things, again, taxing vaping at different rates is a harm reduction strategy, or at different rates than you tax cigarettes is a harm reduction strategy. So is this decriminalization and counseling proposal that you've got. It feels like, and you've also kind of highlighted that the determinations of whether we pursue these strategies comes from these two competing mindsets. The prohibition and abstention and versus we're going to have to live with these charges and civilize these things. So what are you doing to make the harm reduction strategy or persuade more people that the harm reduction strategy is the way to go?
So far in my short time, I've been focusing a lot on writing. So putting out a lot of just, you know, educational commentaries and pieces. So I've got two out right now. One I did on our consumer freedom team. So this is one aspect, it's a different aspect of harm reduction, actually, that we were talking about, where I focus on nicotine alternatives. So talking about actually the inclusion of e-cigarettes in smoking cessation programs. Because even though it's not the ideal outcome, right, even though it's not, you know, people quitting smoking entirely, it moves us in the right direction because e-cigarettes are actually less harmful than smoking a real cigarette. And so I explain that. I add my sources, the endorsements from the New England Journal of Medicine. So I compiled that in minutes and some of my beginning times here. And then on the drug policy team, I have actually taken a route of a specific route right now in maternal health, which I don't even know how this popped up, but there's been a lot of stuff going on with hospitals using urine drug screens on people who are pregnant, which are notoriously unreliable, and taking that result and using that to put children in protective custody and make an attempt at taking their kids away. I'm taking this time to kind of just bring what's relevant and bring forward the important aspects of harm reduction from that. So that's been my strategy thus far. It's been working pretty well. It's been catching eyes since people are like, you know, like, since it's relatively new, and when you frame it a certain way and in your line of work, and you know, point out the certain aspects of it that are harm reduction, and you know, why are hospitals trying to act like law enforcement? This sounds a little funny to me. And you know, we when you point it out that way, it really opens people's eyes, right, to what it means to kind of shift that mindset from all drugs are bad to, okay, our system is flawed and we should maybe take this on a as on a human level basis. So,
okay, so I want to kind of highlight just in reviewing a couple of the things that you've said today about how to change people's minds on this issue. You've got reframing the issue, as in here's one framework to look at it, here's another. You should at least chew on this alternative for a bit. You've got, there are some real people affected by this. I want to tell their stories and how my policies and recommendations can help them. You've covered a lot of empirical evidence that ought to be persuasive. As in, people have looked at the effects of these things and they found important they found things that ought to inform the public debate, and that's some of the things that you're bringing to the table. And you've also covered that there's some unique issues that are around that people ought to know about, some real harms that are happening around the country that have like esoteric reasons that we should try and understand because we can do better. Those are all really interesting strategies to try and change people's hearts and minds. How did you get into the policy world? I mean, it seems like a big difference from working in a clinic to researching and writing about harm prevention.
Honestly, I got into this work because I seen up close just how broken the actual system is. So when I was younger, I thought I wanted to be a medical doctor. I even minored in substance use in undergrad because I knew that medical school didn't really cover addictions. So I wanted to be prepared. And so in those classes, I really became fascinated and honestly kind of shocked by how complex addiction is and how little support is available for the people who are struggling.
Where'd you go to undergrad?
I went to Central Michigan University.
Fire up chips.
Fire up chips. And so it's in those classes, I realized it wasn't just a medical issue and that it was just that the entire system is just failing people. And so after college, that made me really second guess what I wanted to do. So naturally, you know, being unsure of what I wanted to do, I jumped into a master's program, as most of us do. And so I went to Johns Hopkins for my master's. I got it in biotech, which was a really great balance between science and innovation. And, you know, I have a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit to me. So it was a really great program to be in. And while I was there, I jumped into research at the School of Medicine at the Division of Addiction Medicine. And so that's where I started my clinical trial coordination and, you know, fell even more in love with, you know, learning people's stories and looking at how hospital systems impact care and looking at how on a macro level we really impact care and what hospitals can do. And so, I mean, there were a lot of instances where I saw people were trying to get better, right? People were trying to get better, but the system was so stacked against them, whether it be medication availability, whether it be what their insurance covers, whether it be just in general, even transportation to the hospital, down to as simple as that, right? So that's when it clicked for me that as much as I love like the clinical side of things and I'm a science nerd and I love, you know, being in the clinic and being one-on-one with patients, I wanted to change the system. I wanted to do more. And, you know, as I was searching for a way to do more, I came upon Reason and a whole team of people who do drugs, drug policy. And it was the best thing. Ever since I've been in this space, I've really felt like I'm doing what I'm supposed to do and really harnessing all of my loves and my passions and my experience to really, really make some significant change here.
Why do you think the Reason's approach resonated with you?
The specifically that I got asked to do harm reduction. Okay. I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, I'm sold. Because one of my big things, right, coming from, you know, the clinic was I want to work on medication-assisted treatments. You know, that's life-changing for people. And it seems to be a really big, you know, kind of hill to climb, especially when it comes to like just supply side things, talking about what kind of medications are available. Even like it's so complicated down to even the the street reputation of being on a medication is even like, you know, I've heard patients tell me, you know, like, no, I don't want to be on buprenorphine, like, then my friends will make fun of me. And it's like, you know, these things, it's just such a complex issue and something that I really wanted to tackle. So when they asked me to work on harm reduction, I'm like, I love you all. I love you already. And I do. I love Reason. It's the perfect place for me.
Leah, thank you for coming on and good luck in your efforts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.